Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery. In part four of our series on the field of epigenetics, we interviewed one of the leading scientists and advocates in the field, also the chair at the Keystone Conference of Epigenomics and Human Disease Susceptibility in Asheville, North Carolina.
Moshe Schiff, professor of pharmacology at McGill University.
Epigenetics is the study of heritable changes in gene expression or cellular phenotype caused by mechanisms other than changes in the underlying DNA sequence, hence the name epi, meaning over, above, and outer. In the last 37 years, Canadian Moshe Schiff has made some shocking discoveries. His research done at a suicide brain bank in Quebec gives us a whole new perspective on suicide, confirming social policy goes hand in hand with biology. And he even ponders the epigenetic consequences of social media and suggests sites like Facebook could change the architecture of our brains, the way we look, behave, and think.
We're changing the environment. We're changing the social environment. There's no question. What is going to be the impact on humans is still unclear, but it's definitely a fascinating research question.
In keeping with the trend of almost all the leading epigeneticists in this SQ Radio series, Moshe Schiff arrived to the field of epigenetics on a very indirect route. And like many others too, he came from a background prioritizing ethics and philosophy.
I actually started my university career in philosophy and political sciences. And then family pressures moved me to dental school. And upon completion of dental school, I had to do a thesis. So I was then at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And Aaron Razin, who was just pioneering the field of DNA methylation, he just discovered the methyl group on Phi-X-174, which was the first model system to study DNA methylation. And we had no idea, you know, how far it will go. It was just a bacteriophage. And I met him, and he agreed to supervise me. And then I started doing it, and I fell in love with it, with DNA methylation, and that was 37 years ago.
According to experts in the field, Moshe Schiff's work has led to a paradigm shift with regards to the influence of the social and physical environment on the human genome. His research shows that DNA methylation, an epigenetic modification that changes the appearance and structure of DNA without altering its sequence, can actually change after the gestation period. And he bucks the theory that it was ever fixed.
We have been working for 20 years, we means the field, on understanding how DNA methylation is involved in cellular differentiation and explaining how, you know, one genome can have multiple phenotypes in a human or in an animal that is a multicellular organism. But we always thought that once an organism is completed at birth, that's it. The methylation pattern doesn't change. We also thought that DNA methylation pattern is similar amongst individuals. So nobody looked into DNA methylation as a source of inter-individual variation. And the idea was that DNA methylation is fixed. And if it's fixed, it's impossible for it to be responsive to the environment, except maybe during gestation. But I never bought this idea that DNA methylation is fixed. There's no reaction in biology that is fixed. They're all reversible at some point. And we worked first in cancer, where we saw rampant changes in DNA methylation and in the enzymes that regulate methylation, and especially enzymes that remove DNA methylation. So that gave us a first idea that DNA methylation can change between individuals, it can cause cancer, and that it is dynamically regulated. And at some point, I think in the early 90s, I met Michael Meany, who was working on maternal care. And so I was already developing these ideas of a dynamic DNA methylation, but in cancer. And he told me about this amazing phenomena that differences in maternal care will result in different phenotypes in the offspring, which is something I never thought about. And even though he had strong evidence that it's not genetic, because he could cross-foster the mothers, and it wasn't the biological mother, but it was the fostering mother that defined the phenotype of the pup. And that suggested that there is something going on that memorizes that maternal experience. And working on DNA methylation, I thought that perhaps the mother's attachment is altering the DNA methylation pattern in the offspring, and that's how later in life they exhibit different phenotypes. So we started studying it, and we have been providing evidence that that's true. But that was the first indication that the environment, in this case, an amazing social environment, and that was even more radical. I mean, we could understand that some poisons could, you know, change DNA methylation, but that the social environment could change DNA methylation was something we didn't think about. But that was exactly fitting with where I was with the cancer and in looking at a dynamic DNA methylation pattern.
You can say that, or you say that cancer is an epigenetic disease.
Cancer is an epigenetic disease and could be treated by epigenetic drugs. And I would say that perhaps a large fraction of human disease is epigenetic.
What has been overall response to that?
So even for cancer, you know, when I presented my first abstract in a DNA methylation meeting, they refused to publish it in the abstract book because they said it's, one of the reviewers said it was a misguided attempt at scientific humor. And it was a tremendous rejection of the idea that DNA methylation participates in anything except cellular differentiation. And if it participates in cellular differentiation, the feeling was it has to be strong, it has to be fixed, because otherwise we will constantly change, you know, our differentiation, which is something that can't happen. But the cancer story became more and more accepted, and now, as we know, a lot of drug companies are developing drugs against DNA methylation enzymes, and DNA methylation diagnostics is big in cancer, so I think that discussion is over. But now a new discussion started, whether the environment can actually change DNA methylation after birth and throughout life. And I think that jury is not out yet. There is a lot of resistance to accept that, especially from hardcore molecular biologists.
This radical idea that DNA methylation can change due to environmental conditions and that our experiences can influence our phenotype, malleable long after we are born, is hard for many of us to swallow.
I don't know why it is that, but I think it has to do with dogmas, right? So, you know, if we felt for so many years that DNA methylation does not change after birth, that all the changes in DNA methylation happen during, you know, early differentiation, early development, then we feel uncomfortable that such a mechanism that is so critical for differentiating cells will be dynamic as well. You know, it seems like a contradiction. And that's one thing. I think the other thing is that the effects that one sees in the brain are not as large as the effects that one sees in a cancer. And the difference is very clear. A cancer is a clonal population. So every cell is similar to the other cell. So once you have a change in methylation and that cell replicates, all the cells will have the same change. So the changes in cancer are 100 to 0. Whereas in the brain, one or few neurons change because you experience something. The changes in methylation will be in the few percent range. And even these are big changes. Probably most of the changes are in the point something percent range. So that's another problem. When you move from, you know, very strong methylation changes, like in differentiation, where the entire system changes its methylation, to cancer, where again, all the cells, or most of the cells, go the same way, to what happens in the brain, it's hard to accept.
Through the course of Moshe Sheff's career, he has developed what he calls a brain bank to study the physical effects of adversity on our brains. Through brain scanning, he is finding clear evidence that indeed, victimization as a child leaves its mark.
The first study we did was with rats. As interesting as rats are, we're interested to know, is it true for humans? You know, do humans have the same things? And with humans, it's very hard to study questions like this because we can't do experiments with humans, and we definitely don't have access to brains in humans except after they die. And so we took advantage of an amazing resource, which is the Quebec Brain Bank that was founded by a colleague of mine, Dr. Gustavo Turecki. And essentially what's interesting about that brain bank is that every victim of suicide in Quebec whose brain comes to this bank and the control groups are very well phenotyped. So we can now go backwards and say whether this, as a human being, was abused as a child or not abused as a child, and other issues. So we wanted to see whether differences in paternal or maternal care would be reflected in methylation patterns in adulthood. So we took brains of adults who were either victimized as children or went through normal childhood. We had two groups of people who committed suicide, because that was the original goal of this brain bank, to study suicide, and we had a control group. We were very careful that they would be the same age, they were all males, to avoid gender issues, and we looked at the same areas where we looked in the rats, and we found a similar change in methylation in brains of people who were abused as children, and that was different from people who either committed suicide or not, who were not abused as children. So these marks seem to be associating with childhood abuse. And what's remarkable about it is that we're looking at 35 years old, and we can see those marks in the brain.
These marks then are developed during their childhood.
That's our guess. Of course, we can't study that, because to study it properly, you had to, you know, sample them throughout their life, which is impossible to do in the brain, and therefore we're trying to do it in blood. So our current studies are trying to ask the question whether similar marks will be found in the immune system, which is much more accessible to epidemiological studies. So we went to first to study monkeys, where we could have sampled brain and blood at the same time. And we looked at the same in this same similar question. We looked at monkeys who were essentially deprived of maternal care because they were removed from their mothers when they were young, and control groups. And that's the fantastic world of another colleague of mine, Stephen Swamy, who has been interested in the effects of maternal and maternal attachment on the phenotype. And again, in monkeys, like in rats, like in humans, the mother has a tremendous impact on the phenotype of the offspring. And so we compare the methylation pattern here in the brain and in blood. And now we're finalizing the study, and we're seeing similar results where many, many regions in the DNA, in the genome, are differentially methylated based on whether the monkey had a mother or not when he was young.
Rather than studying behavioral disorders, Mosheshev is focusing on the environments that produce different behaviors.
We have a study that we just completed looking at people from different socioeconomic positioning and looking at adversity or economic adversity early in life and economic adversity later in life. So we have four groups: those who are adverse early in life but rich later in life, and vice versa, and those who maintain adversity throughout life, and those who maintained relaxed conditions throughout life. And we compare their methylation pattern, but this time in the blood, because these people are alive. And again, here we took advantage of a longitudinal study that has been gone for more than 50 years. It's the British Birth Cohort of 1958. And so these people are 50 years old, but we have good records of their history. And we compare their DNA methylation pattern, and that was done in collaboration with University College of London and University of British Columbia, with Clyde Hertzman and Marcus Pembry and Chris Power. And we could distinguish in the blood signatures of DNA methylation that seemed to associate with adversity in childhood, irrespective of what happened to these people later on in life.
Wow. And how was that manifesting in these people?
It was manifested in changes in DNA methylation, right? So the people we looked at were healthy people, but they came from extreme differences in socioeconomic positioning. But the epidemiological data suggests that people who suffered adversity in life will have a whole gamut of health problems later in life, from mental health down to physical health, whether it's obesity, diabetes, and mental problems, etc. But we specifically did not focus on sick people. We focused on people who otherwise look healthy. Of course, the next interesting question will be, how could these predict who will be at risk to suffer from cardiovascular, diabetes, mental health problems later in life? And of course, that's the greatest challenge
thing right now.
So our guess is that we will be able to identify DNA methylation marks early in life that could predict susceptibility to disease later in life. And that could change the way we intervene. For example, rather than intervening with the entire population, which is expensive, if we can do prevention early in life, we can probably eradicate those differences if we identify those people who are at risk. But the nature of things is that even people who come from very low socioeconomic positioning with very high adversity, many of them are resilient and they will do extremely well. So we don't want to waste time on these people. The challenge is to identify those people at risk. So the nature of DNA methylation is that it is potentially reversible. As we talked before, it is dynamic. And dynamic means it can get on and get off. So on one hand, it's very stable. On the other hand, it is potentially reversible.
And to reverse DNA methylation, drugs might be the answer. Moshe Sheff founded the first company dedicated to epigenetics called Methylgene, located in Montreal, Canada, and the concept has picked up where many epigenetic drug companies are popping up all over the world.
And it could be reversed potentially by either very strong behavioral interventions, like strong diets, strong cognitive interventions, or by drugs, the same drugs that we use for cancer. And actually, some of the drugs that were used in cancer are now being tried in mental health, for example, with this idea that we can reverse deleterious DNA methylation signals.
So this could have huge implications then, too, for mental disorders.
Yes. Absolutely. There is no difference in the basis of it between mental and physical problems. They all involve, the way we look at it, problems in gene expression, and these are regulated by DNA methylation and other epigenetic factors. So there's no reason why a drug that can work on cancer should not work on a mental health situation if the basic molecular problem is very similar.
But how far off is that from being determined?
We're very far and we're very near. So what we have now are drugs that are not very clean, but I know that they are being tested. So and a good example is one drug that has been used for decades in mental health, which is called valproic acid, which we know is an epigenetic drug. We didn't know that in the past, but now we know it is an epigenetic drug. So there is a drug that is working and is being used that is an epigenetic drug. And I know about clinical trials that are taking, for example, what we call HDAC inhibitors, which are epigenetic drugs, in certain conditions in mental health. There are animal studies that suggest that some of these drugs can promote memory.
Now Moshe Sheff is leading studies looking at human aggression through the lens of epigenetics. Scientists have not found a violence gene, nor do they expect to discover one. Instead, Moshe Sheff and team are attempting to tease out the complex interactions among genetics, environmental influences, and violence and aggression. The idea is that certain genetic traits, when combined with life experiences, can help propel a person towards a life of crime. Still, much remains unknown. If Moshe Sheff and his team are right, their work could lead to the development of biologically targeted social programs or the administration of drugs to counter the genes in a toxic environment.
If somebody is aggressive, is it because of some free will or is it because his DNA is marked? And can we use it in court? Can we use it as an argument to defend somebody that it wasn't his responsibility, it was his DNA, either that was mutated by genetics or was marked by epigenetics, and it's his mother's responsibility? I mean, these are complex issues. What does DNA methylation imply as far as human responsibility? Both responsibility of the environment, the social environment, when somebody abuses an employee or a soldier or a student or a child, might have long-term consequences beyond the abuse itself that can change the behavior of the abused, and then that behavior could be criminal. So who is responsible for that criminality? And I know that a lot of law experts are interested in those questions because they do have legal manifestation. And that shows you the wide appeal of epigenetics. I think people are interested in epigenetics come now from political sciences, from history, from social sciences. For example, historical forces are forces that are driving probably epigenetic powers, you know, changing environments, moving, you know, attacking a country and creating aggression in a country. Aggression is connected to maternal care. And so we know this from animal studies and human studies. So whether it's shooting or other forms of aggression, there is strong data that associates adolescent aggression with maternal care. And I'm just collaborating with a colleague in Montreal, Richard Tremblay, who is looking at that aggression. And actually, the best predictor of aggression was maternal education. And maternal education is a proxy for essentially maternal care and attention. And he has done a few interventions that actually helped. And one of the interventions he did was a very rich daycare environment that kind of substituted for the mother. Or for maternal education. Okay. But an educated mother will read more to their children, will, you know, overall pay more attention to the children, and it's kind of a surrogate marker of maternal care, really. So there's multiple questions from all fields of human scholarship and activity that have an epigenetic basis for.
Through Simply Living, it is widely accepted that child abuse offenders were often abused themselves. Mosheshev is proving, scientifically demonstrating, physical scarring in the brain tissue is an artifact of abuse. It will be interesting to see if our history is showing up in this biological evidence of epigenetic markers. Will this lead to social reform? Mosheshev leans towards yes and exudes a refreshing optimism for politicians.
Policy-making people depends on their education and intelligence. Some of them are getting interested. It doesn't mean it had an impact yet. I mean, to be honest, a lot of this stuff was known. I mean, we knew that poverty isn't good. We knew that abuse isn't good. But I think what epigenetics is giving hard molecular marks for that and hard evidence in science. So it's not anymore the magic of somehow abuse causes bad behavior later in life. But there is a chemical process that that leads from abuse to changes in behavior or to changes in health. That has policy implications. And I think sooner or later, they will pick it up. And I was approached by the ex-prime minister of Canada, who was interested in the Aboriginals in Canada. And one of the things that happened to Aboriginals in Canada was that they were moved to residential schools. They were moved essentially from their parents into residential school, exactly like those monkeys and those rats. And so here you have a population that was victimized by very early in life that is exactly the model that we are studying. And what's interesting about that population, have a very high suicide risk, one of the highest in the world. It's very hard to establish at this stage that it's the removal of kids from their home to residential school that caused it, but it's plausible. And policymakers are looking at that and saying, wait a minute, there might be a mechanism that can explain it. But what's interesting about the Aboriginals is that these changes happened 3 generations ago. And so we see now effects of the 3rd generation, whose grandmother or grandfather were removed from their homes when they were little kids. Easier. And so now the big question is, are there markers that show up or not? We haven't looked at it. But this idea came not from me, came from a politician, which means they understand what we're doing and they're applying it and they're asking the right questions.
Okay. Mosheshev depicts certain areas where he foresees epigenetics informing social programs and catalyzing intervention.
So one of the things we learned from animals is that good intervention can substitute for a mother. And so, you know, one policy implication could be having high quality childcare. It costs a lot of money, but economists are now calculating how much money that would save later on. And, you know, jail time and criminality and the health. The Europeans are much more sensitive to these issues. And I think we are going in a transition between the genetic age where essentially we thought whatever genes you have will throw you anywhere and you will do well. You know, you can have a parent, no parent, it won't make any difference because your genes are good. And there's some people who think this way. But I think once we shift away from this and we realize that the genes need to interact and be sculpted by the environment, and we'll start paying attention to the environment. And And we'll start doing the calculations, both the social, political, and economic calculations, that some investments are worth it because in the end they're going to save us money. Epigenetics and economics are going to be very interesting partners in the next decade or so.
Word is getting out and proliferating into mainstream media as scientists and policymakers are internalizing the shocking and rather satisfying implications of epigenetics. Its arms extend into infinite disciplines, inevitably drawing attention to the likely enormous impact of toxic environments on human behavior. Research at the Keystone Conference in North Carolina cemented the role of epigenetics in disease and human behavior.
The fantastic thing about this meeting, comparing to, you know, let's say 2 years earlier or 5 years earlier, you saw how much work is coming up. And once you spread these things, you don't need to do it yourself. The whole world is doing it. So I think we are going to generate a huge amount of data on the relationships between environments and human health and behavior. We've seen different kinds of studies that will provide the knowledge from different kind of corners of this question. I think epigenetics will eventually become a very powerful diagnostic tool, predictive tool. Probably no physician will work without getting epigenetic data before and after and throughout. I think prevention will use a lot of epigenetic data and epigenetic mechanism to kind of conceive about prevention strategies, both at the population level and at the individual level. Epigenetics might change the way we do preventions. It might focus it on the right populations. And it might have an impact on our thinking, on our philosophy, on questions of responsibility, or questions of, you know, what is the significance of a family? What is the significance of a mother? You know, what is the significance of a society? What is the significance of the workplace? And we were very concerned for, you know, a century about poisons, lead, PCB, and there's a lot of work on these, of course, are epigenetic modifiers. But what I'm trying to emphasize is that it's not just lead or PCB. Perhaps there are many more toxic environments which are social environments. Mm-hmm. And I think by having hard markers, we will pay more respect to the social environments. I mean, social evolution evolved certain behaviors that we completely got rid of in a century, right? We had a reason why we had a family. Obviously, it worked, and probably we tried different things during evolution till that form worked. And we recognized that it worked, and those who came from a family probably had an advantage, and that's why family survived. And now, in our century, because we were so smart, we thought that just by ideology we can get away with social evolution. We can just do whatever we think is right. And we paid very little respect to biology. And a lot of the social scientists and social activists, you know, a lot of social activism had paid no respect to biology. Like asking the question, what is the biological implication lack of maternal care, of single parenthood, of, you know, a lot of things that we're doing because they're cool. But we never ask the question, what is the biological implication? I don't think you can have social policy without biology. We're changing the environment. We're changing the social environment. There's no question. What is going to be the impact on humans is still unclear, but it's definitely a fascinating research question. You know, is a social media environment similar to just hanging out with friends in a bar? And what kind of impact it will have on our health and behavior? I don't know, but I'm sure people are going to look into it. Yeah. The epigenetic consequences of social media. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to part 4. The Biology of Aggression, in our series Epigenetics 101. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.